From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The acclaimed Latin American journalist and author, Eduardo Galeano, died Monday at the age of 74. Telesur's Cody Weddle has more.
His best-known book, The Open Veins of Latin America, told the story of five centuries of pillage and plunder at the hands of successive colonial and imperial interests. For many inside and outside Latin America, it was the book that introduced them to a different version of the continent, its past and its present.
El mundo no está hecho de átomos. El mundo está hecho de historias.
The world is not made of atoms. The world is made of stories. I believe that the world should be made of stories because the stories that one tells, that one recites, that one diffuses, the stories that are allowed to convert the past into the present and also make the distant become close and possible. The world has a huge amount of people, a sea of tiny flames. There are no two flames alike. Every person shines with his or her light.
Lo que está lejano en algo próximo y posible y visible.
In an interview with Telesur in September of 2013, Galeano spoke of the legacy of the former Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez.
La verdadera memoria.
The true memory is the memory that lives in us. And in this, it is more than clear that Hugo Chavez lives in the collective memory of these people and in the memory of the people of Latin America and many other people outside of Latin America, but those that learned the invaluable lesson of dignity.
And Bolivian President Evo Morales also expressed his sadness on behalf of the Bolivian people. He calls Galeano a master of decolonization and liberation.
On behalf of the Bolivian people, I express our condolences for the loss of our brother Eduardo Galeano. Not only Bolivia, not only Latin America, but the world loses one of its most important figures. The world loses a master of decolonization and of the liberation of our nations.
Galeano was eulogized Monday by noted author, journalist, and political commentator Tariq Ali. Ali said that what Bolivar did with his sword, Galeano did with his pen.
Galeano was a very unique person in the history of the South American continent. What Simon Bolivar accomplished with his sword, Galeano attempted to accomplish with his pen. He wrote about the entire continent. He covered aspects of history that had been unknown to many, many people in South America. He wrote about the indigenous people. He wrote about the workers of South America who built the lines on which trains crossed borders. He was a lyrical journalist. And I think he was both optimistic and pessimistic. His will was very optimistic. His intellect could be pessimistic. Why? Because he had observed with his own eyes the period of military dictatorships in South America, when American imperialism attempted to crush the resistance in every single South American country. And in Galeano's own country, Uruguay, the repression was vicious. So he's lived through that phase, and then he lived to see the rise of the World Social Movement in Porto Alegre. He lived to see the victory of the Bolivarians in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Bolivia. He lived to see the recovery of democracy in his own country, Uruguay, and he saw Mojica become the president of Uruguay, a former Tupamaros guerrilla. So he naturally felt both pessimistic and optimistic. And the most important thing about him is that his example of writing pure, truthful journalism, of telling stories about the lives of ordinary people, that many young journalists today could learn from.
The rising death toll from fighting in Yemen prompted the UN's top human rights official, Zayed Ra'ad Al Hussein, on Tuesday to call for the warring parties to take maximum care in protecting civilians. The development follows reports from the UN's Human Rights Office that airstrikes by Saudi Arabia have caused at least 1,000 casualties. Latest UN figures as of Monday showed at least 750 civilian deaths and more than 2,000 people injured. Daniel Johnson has more.
In his appeal, the UN's top human rights official called for all sides involved in the conflict to ensure that international humanitarian law was scrupulously respected. Zayed Ra'ad Al Hussein's declaration comes amid reports that dozens of public buildings, including hospitals, schools and mosques, have been targeted in recent aerial attacks. In a statement on Tuesday, the High Commissioner also demanded that attacks resulting in civilian casualties are promptly investigated. Ravina Shamdasani is the High Commissioner's spokesperson.
Every hour we're receiving and documenting deeply disturbing and distressing reports of the toll that this conflict is taking on civilian lives and infrastructure. The High Commissioner warns that such a heavy civilian death toll ought to be a clear indication to all parties to this conflict that there may be serious problems in the conduct of hostilities.
The UN official said that street fighting had intensified in densely populated areas, including Aden in the south of the country. And there's been reported child recruitment in Aden, Dali and Mareb as fighting continues between ousted President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi on one side and those affiliated with the Houthis and former President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Meanwhile, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that 121,000 people had been internally displaced since airstrikes began on the 26th of March, mainly in the country's northwest. UN Children's Fund UNICEF also said that a second airlift had successfully arrived in the country, carrying 76 tons of mainly medical equipment and water supplies. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
Among the casualties is at least one American, and as U.S. citizens flee the war zone, thousands more remain trapped. RT's Rory Suchet has more.
More than 120,000 people have been displaced in Yemen. This since the start of the Saudi bombing campaign last month. And this all according to the very latest UN data. Foreign nationals continue to flee the war zone, including 150 Americans in the past 2 days. They were whisked out of the country on Russian and Indian ships. But there are still thousands more U.S. citizens still stuck in Yemen, and they are demanding action from Washington.
I mean, I hear everything that goes on. We hear gunshots, we hear bombs, we hear airstrikes. I've been at home stuck for like two weeks now, right now, and they treated us like a second-class citizens or like nobody.
I am stuck, like you could say. I'm in the middle of Yemen. There's like a 5 hour drive from here to Sana'a, and there is no transportation. There is no gas here. We can't even go anywhere.
The State Department has said that it does not yet have a plan in place to evacuate its citizens from Yemen, and at least one American civilian has already been killed in the conflict. Jamal Alabani died after being hit by shrapnel in the port city of Aden. He is survived by his daughter and pregnant widow, who are still trapped in Yemen. I spoke with his cousin, Mohammed Alazani.
There is not just my family, there's thousands of others that are still trapped there. Those who want to Yemen are actually, they have families there. If someone's mother or father is in Yemen, you have to go visit them once in a blue moon. Even if there is a recommendation of danger, it's not prohibited. They didn't break the law to be punished this way.
Certainly there's been a wave of backlash here. Several individuals and human rights organizations are now saying they will sue the U.S. government for refusing to evacuate Americans from Yemen.
Oh, definitely. Pretty much the whole community. I mean, if our government are not doing anything, we have to push more for an action. They have to take this issue really seriously. I mean, we're thinking if it was somewhere else in a Europe country or another developed country, street, they will definitely take it more seriously. I don't know if it's more of like a racial issue, but I mean, we feel that we were neglected and then they have to take it more seriously. And
you bring in the issue of negligence here. Certainly, it's raising some eyebrows. For example, China and India have been rescuing nationals from Yemen. Even Somalia has been going in there doing military extractions. America, with the most powerful military in the world, why is it not fishing out the rest of its citizens?
Well, actually, we had the same exact question for them, and we haven't any answer. We haven't got any answers yet.
At the UN Security Council Tuesday, a resolution was approved 14-0 with one abstention, demanding that all parties in the embattled country, particularly the Houthis, immediately and unconditionally end the violence there, with a call on all parties to facilitate the evacuation of foreign nationals and international aid personnel from Yemen. In explaining his abstention, Vitaly Churkin, the permanent representative of the Russian Federation, said the text failed to take into account proposals that his government had made calling on all sides to halt fire as the Saudi air campaign continues into its fourth week and the totals of civilian fatalities approaches 1,000. Churkin also said that the resolution lacked clarity on a humanitarian ceasefire. Meanwhile, Iran offered a comprehensive plan for a settlement of the crisis in Yemen. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe has more.
Iran has proposed a four-point plan for resolving the crisis in Yemen. The plan has been announced by Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif during a visit to the Spanish capital, Madrid. Zarif says that Iran's list of proposals for Yemen includes an immediate ceasefire and supplies of humanitarian assistance. He also says there should be an intra-Yemeni dialogue among local factions to look for ways to resolve the crisis. According to the plan, an agreement needs to be reached by regional and other powers that Yemen should have a broad-based government friendly to all its neighbors. Zarif also reiterated Tehran's position that the Saudi military campaign in Yemen is only making the problem worse. He's also warned European countries that the military conflict in Yemen may worsen if they insist on preconditions before diplomatic talks.
As we reported earlier in the week, Russia recently agreed to share some of its most advanced air defense systems with Iran and China. The moves have serious strategic implications for both the Middle East and East Asia. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Mark Sloboda, security analyst and senior lecturer and researcher in international relations and security studies at Moscow State University. We spoke with him from Moscow via Skype Tuesday.
The significance of all of this is that the timing. The deal with China has been in the works for several years now. There have been concerns before, including intellectual property rights. There's always been a threat that China would basically take the technology and proceed to make their own, cutting the Russian defense industry out of the system. My understanding is that China has now been very accommodating and all of the intellectual property concerns have been put into place. Also, with Iran, the condition was that in 2010, the UN put sanctions on Iran for its nuclear program that included prohibition against the sale of offensive weapon systems to Iran. Now, the S-300 is obviously not an offensive weapon system, but it is an extremely advanced air and ballistic missile defense system. The U.S. and Israel lobbied very, very hardly to get then Russian President Dmitry Medvedev to institute a ban on a sale of S-300s to Iran. And this is when Russia had previously, before Medvedev became president, already agreed to supply Iran with S-300s. So Russia basically defaulted on its own contract. Iran was going to take them to court to sue them for a not insignificant amount of change for breaking the contract, and it actually put Russia's the integrity of Russia's defense industry to deliver on their product in jeopardy. A lot of people in Russia were very unhappy with this stance by Medvedev, and it was seen as a very big foreign policy victory in the U.S. as part of the, shall we say, BS U.S.-Russian reset that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton so incorrectly in Russian spoke of. Both of these being announced, the completion of the contract being signed with China and the fact that Russia under Putin will now lift this ban and supply this air defense system to Iran, the S-300 version, known in NATO parlance as the SA-20 Gargoyle. This is, I believe, something that's not being discussed at all in the Western press. I believe that this is a direct response to the West supplying weapons to the Kiev regime in Ukraine, weapons and trainers. No one that I've seen has drawn that linkage yet. I think it's not insignificant. I think Russia has knowledge that the West is now supplying much more advanced arms to the Kiev regime. This is what my sources in Moscow are telling me. And that this is Putin acting decisively without any possibility of this being a bluff or, playing a card, as it were. This is a done deal, and Russia sees this as, if you will, revenge or payback. It is an asymmetric response to the West supplying advanced arms to the Kiev regime in the Ukraine. This is really significant.
I agree with that.
In military terms, let's talk separately quickly about what this each does for both of the situations.
Because that's why before you go there, because that's why I was wondering if it really is asymmetrical when you consider the military situation with the complete encirclement of Russia. You're shoring up air defenses basically for Russia in these two cases.
Yeah, well, for Russia's geopolitical partners.
Right.
And
its geography, too, really. I mean, if you can cover the air over Iran, then they can't enter Russia through Iran unless they use the stealth craft.
Well, there's no real direct way to come, nothing with a range to come at Russia through Iran. There's much easier ways to come at Russia.
Of course.
Much more practical ways. But what this weapon does, in terms of Iran, the S-300, let's talk about that one first, the SA-20, the Gargoyle. What this system, first of all, the S-300 series, the S-400, S-300, S-400, S-500, is hands down, unquestioned, the most advanced air defense system in the world. It buries the Patriot or anything else the United States has. This, for years, the only piece since the 1990s, the only piece of Russian military gear that was always superior to the United States was air defense. And the reason for that is very simple. It's because the U.S., the NATO way of war, is predicated on complete and overpowering air supremacy. They're very, very good at it. Right. They can bomb the bejesus out of any country in the world that they wish previously. So the Soviet Union, then Russia, spent a lot of money to counter that cost effectively, not with a fleet of their own fighter craft capable of taking, although, you know, no one's going to sneeze at the MiGs either.
Right.
They spent a lot of money on this particular anti-aircraft defense system. And this system can take out aircraft, any fourth-gen aircraft, F-15s, F-16s, anything, right? They make minced meat out of fourth-gen aircraft. Mm. It can take on equal terms, even stealth aircraft, okay? It has it makes flying even stealth aircraft extremely dangerous. The S-400 series in particular is designed specifically to counter stealth aircraft.
Right.
But even the S-300 has a better than average chance of taking a stealth aircraft down.
Right.
It can take down intercontinental ballistic missiles. And it can take down drones. It can take down anything that flies this can knock it out of the sky. And it has a huge range, right? It can hit targets, the S-400, from up to 250 kilometers away.
Wow.
And it provides complete radar coverage from up to 3,000 kilometers away, right? Mm. Target and acquisition. It can simultaneously track up to 36 different targets. Wow. And fire on 7 of them. Whoa. The most advanced version has a 4-second response time. Whoa. Between firing it and between identifying a target and the destruction of that target.
That's a bad system. Yeah, right.
A U.S. Marine Corps aviation general said on this that this is a dangerous beast and we don't want to go anywhere near it. So in military parlance, what everyone is talking about in both of these situations, the euphemism that the U.S. uses is one that they hate. It's denial of access. Right. And what denial of access means is that the U.S. can't enforce its political will on these countries any longer by bombing the living snot out of them back into the Stone Age.
Right. And what it doesn't – yeah. So, and you've got with this military capability now, let's go to geopolitical aspects of it. First, the regional ones. Suddenly, Israel can't bomb Iran anymore.
Exactly. Israel cannot make a unilateral attack on Iran. Period. They have no chance at anymore once these systems are installed. There's nothing that Israel has that can penetrate this system. It even means that if the U.S. were to make assist Israel in an attack on Iran, say at these hardened nuclear development sites, bunkers, that the only aircraft that the U.S. could rely on that could not be immediately shot down out of the sky, that would have at least a chance of penetrating the network and coming back alive, would be the B-2 Spirit bombers, stealth bombers.
And they'd be at risk.
And they'd be at a huge risk. Right. And the Navy only – the Air Force only has 20 of them.
Yeah, they've never had a risk before. I mean, look at the scenario in both Iraq and Libya, which were their preferred scenarios. Yep. In Iraq, first of all, they starved the country and bombed it for a decade before they went in there. And in the case of Libya, they secured a no-fly resolution against the government of Libya, so they couldn't go into the air even without violating a UN resolution. And they took out, with cruise missiles, their air defense systems, and then with NATO's Air Force, took out their defense systems. That's the way they like to play. There was no S-300 in Libya, for example.
No. This is interesting because NATO has never actually, or in the U.S., has never really fought an advanced air system.
Right.
The most advanced system that they ever dealt with was a very piecemeal bit of 1970s Soviet gear,
right,
in Serbia.
Right.
And Serbia still managed to take out a stealth bomber, if you'll recall. Right.
Yeah, and more than a few of the others, the fighter jets.
More than a few of the regular fighter jets. So this system scares the West. Right. It was considered a big foreign policy coup to get to have this ban from 2010 to 2015 on the sale to Iran. It seriously changes the nature of the geopolitical game in Iran. Israel, Saudi Arabia can no longer attack Iran with impunity.
Right.
The U.S. could only do so at extreme danger and risk to itself. And even then, with the amount of armament that these B-2s can carry, they don't have a significant chance of completing the mission, which would be to destroy Iran's hardened nuclear bunkers underground. So that is very interesting in the context of the Obama-Iran nuclear deal that, in my opinion, seems to be faltering right now.
All right, now let's pivot to Asia.
All right, so in my opinion, this is where it gets even more interesting.
Yeah.
Now, this really changes the nature of the U.S.'s military goal of surrounding China with a military containment sphere, and this the so-called Asian pivot, and restricting their growth to control their own backyard in the South China Sea. What this does in the situation of Taiwan is it gives China complete air dominance air superiority over the entirety of Taiwan. Okay, which first of all renders Taiwan's American-made fourth-gen fighter fleet completely obsolete, and it also means that any attempt from the U.S. to intervene in any theoretical attempt by China to restore their sovereignty over Taiwan would be completely fruitless. So this is a big deal in Taiwan. It means the same thing for the U.S. for the Chinese Japanese dispute over the Diu or Senkaku island chain. Right. Okay, it also gives China complete air dominance over anything Japan can put in the air over these islands. Right. And even third, even for India, not that, Chinese and Indian relations are on the mend now. China, Russia, and India have a thing going with China supposedly joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But these S-400s are even a threat to India's nuclear deterrent. That's how serious a piece of gear these things are. And so even for India, this is going to change the calculus with China.
Wow. In other words, that removes India's ability to strike China with nuclear weapons, which means China could first strike India, theoretically, if there were still hostilities.
Yes. Wow. It certainly limits their ability to do so. So a lot of people hear, Russia made an air defense sale to Iran and China. Okay. They don't realize that this is such an advanced piece of gear, and because of the way NATO fights its wars with air power, this is a huge geopolitical game changer. It is Vladimir Putin sitting comfortably in the Kremlin, outstretching both hands and raising the middle finger on each of them to the United States.
Gee, I'm sorry to see that, huh?
Yeah. So
in terms of options, for example, that they could play against China, you've had the reinterpretation again of Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, and that coupled with some encounters of Japanese Air Force with the Chinese defenders, the Japanese poking China's air defenses basically near those islands. And you have South Korea, of course, which is also in a position to proxy against China.
Yes.
And that is all negated now, isn't it?
It is countered to a very significant extent.
Right.
It is countered to a very significant extent.
Yeah, from a strategic perspective, it's negated, I guess, right? Because they can't actually threaten the homeland anymore, for sure.
No, it's not anymore about over-threatening the homeland. It's now about dominance over the South China Sea.
Wow. So,
which is to say their own backyard. It's like saying the U.S. now has the ability to control the Gulf of Mexico.
So how does this shake out politically? I mean, you mentioned, for example, it being a game changer between China and Taiwan. Does this have an impact on the psychology of the leadership in Taiwan? And, given that they're both selling to some of the same customers and even doing some complementary business deals, does this mean that perhaps Taiwan might reevaluate its relationship with the United States and China?
Well, my opinion is that a lot of the political elements in Taiwan have already been growing closer to China for years. But there are still political elements that, heed more to the U.S. hegemonic line. And they are immediately calling, they will use this as increased call for the U.S. to deliver stealth systems to Taiwan.
Right. Here in the U.S., the Reverend Edward Pinckney was back in court Tuesday in the continuing saga of his attempt to challenge the powers that be in Benton Harbor, Michigan, known to locals as the company town of the global giant Whirlpool Corporation. In one of the few such cases in the entire country, Pinckney was sentenced to prison after being convicted last November on 5 counts of election law violations after being found guilty of changing the dates on petitions in a recall campaign against that city's mayor. He was convicted by an all-white jury, although Benton Harbor is 96% black, and despite the fact that the petitions in question dealt with a Benton Harbor city election, there was not one person from Benton Harbor on the jury. Reverend Pinckney was back in court Tuesday on a motion for a new trial. That motion was denied, and he was taken in handcuffs back to prison. An appeal of the November conviction is in process, and his spokesperson said an appeal of Tuesday's denial of his motion for a new trial will follow shortly. We'll have details on that tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.